Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Christopher Phillips, the best-selling author of Socrates Cafe and the series of follow-up books, has pondered the value of childhood and what adults can learn from children if we weren't so busy trying to teach them a thing or two. His new book is entitled The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ann. It's wonderful to be here.
You know, as someone who's always known for asking the dumb question, that's me, just simple things like asking questions and being curious are not something necessarily that we value, you realize, when I read your book, and I realize how much we change as we age.
We can actually become much more limited in how we frame questions. And I think if you look at so many of our society's intractable problems, maybe it's because we're not framing questions the right way. And so I make this wacky argument that what if we had kids, what if we brought them up to speed on what we're trying to resolve? And what if we just said, well, how would you, what kind of question might you pose? Could help us. It actually could help us. And I've found that over the last 20-plus years engaging in philosophical inquiry with kids around the globe. They not only have the darndest way of coming up with responses, but they have the darndest way of framing questions in ways that are really a breath of fresh air and can lead to different insights.
The idea of child as a verb isn't new. You found a definition of childing in an old edition of Collins' American Dictionary, and I love it. It's a beautiful notion. Tell us what Collins said.
Well, Collins defined childing as blossoming from a healthy core. And this is a term that came into the human lexicon in the mid-13th century. And Shakespeare used it beautifully, and a poet named Robert Southey. But I asked myself today, at a time when, well, maybe we elected a commander-in-chief who's a poster adult for somewhat smarmish behavior, what can we do to make sure that this next generation blossoms from a healthy core? And what can we do to make sure that all of us at every age and stage of life, even when we're frail and infirm, can blossom, continue blossoming from a healthy core? And I hark back to this word childing and to my dialogues with kids. And it's not just that we need to have kids in our orbit, whether we're parents or not, in ways that we can inquire with them. But in addition to being good examples for them, we also need to look at them and see how they can be good examples for us. And that's when things get interesting, if we can really dispense for some times during the day with the hierarchical approach and engage with them as fellow human beings, different but equal. And my experience is that they can be extraordinary examples of empathy, of listening, of breathtaking inquiry if we give them half a chance and just quit thinking of ourselves as above them, if we really, really, really listen to them with all we got.
You know, the first chapter, you're talking with a group of third graders in Iowa, and when I was reading what those third graders in Iowa were telling you in the first chapter, I had to think that they were not only amazing in their articulation and process of thinking, but I went back and thought to some extent they must be a product of what you call a hyper-utilitarian notion about child rearing. They were amazing.
You know,
look back over the transcript of that conversation and go, whoa?
You know, I didn't. And I'll have to tell you why, because I've had, I think, thousands of these with kids. They don't typically have a chance to just inquire in the regular school day. It's not that they're precocious. It's just that this is an element of them that typically doesn't have a chance for them to show their stuff. I'm not surprised or astonished, but I am endlessly wowed by that ability of them to reveal insights that I otherwise wouldn't be privy to. I wish I could tell you, if anything, that, you know, I had to condense and dilute a little bit. But no, their insights are astonishing. I mean, this is Ames, Iowa, where kids, you know, have parents who are doctors and university backgrounds and things. So, no, that's how they speak.
You note an interesting dichotomy of sorts at the outset as well, that we've never had kids more at the center of our world than now, and that the serendipity and spontaneity of childhood has never been more endangered. And on my way into work this morning, I saw a sign for soccer for kids aged 2 to 6, and I thought of that again. Like, what? what are we doing?
Well, the overscheduled child, the helicopter parenting where we're constantly
learning
hovering.
Rules them. About yes. a game.
Yes. Instead of, and some of that is okay.
Yeah.
And we can talk, you know, about the finding of a balance, striking of a balance.
Yeah.
But some of it is just this endless preparation for adulthood. Instead of recognizing that we're, no matter what age and stage we're at, we're in this constant state of being and becoming. I suspect someday we'll find we're in the dark ages about all the stages that exist in adulthood and that the boundaries are far more blurred than they exist. I get so upset when I hear a president or somebody else who engages in the politics of humiliation described as a clueless child. He's a clueless adult. This is not a normal childlike behavior. When I was writing a blog on my childing.org site about the president, when he was a candidate, mocking the disabled person. And she said, my oldest daughter, Callie, who's 10, she said, "Daddy, is this person running for president?" And I said, "Yes." And she goes, "Well, I would only vote for someone who's nice." And so I made this wacky argument. What if we allowed kids to vote? What if they're not as astute as us adults on the issues, but what if they voted on virtues? They would vote on nice, honest, decent. Would that be so bad? Because all too, yeah.
That's interesting the way you put that. When we frame him or frame anybody like what he does in terms of childhood, we're diminishing childhood.
We're diminishing children.
Children.
We're diminishing who they are and what they are. I mean, pioneering cognitive science studies today show that kids start out with a bang. They are bundles of empathy. They're hardwired for empathy. You drop keys over a pillow, a baby who can just learn to crawl will risk life and limb to rescue those keys for you. If our definition of empathy is that you're trying to be of service to someone, that's what they are. How is it that we lose those qualities over time? As we become adults. And it's really easy to point the finger at one person or put all of our hopes and aspirations in a president or somebody like that. But if we look at ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves, well, are we really those bundles of empathy that we started out as? And if not, then the nagging question is, can we look at children to remind us of who we were, and can we use them as a touchstone to become more and more of this fully flourishing, empathetic human today?
You know, there's an adorable picture of a girl with glasses on the front and a little girl. But this is not, to me, when I was reading the book, it doesn't feel like a how-to book on how to raise children.
It
seems like a philosophical treatise on how to live.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, this is for me in many ways a culmination of my 20 years of philosophizing with people with childlike sensibilities at every age and stage of life and every walk of life. So I realize, though, that the best Socrates Cafe groups, and we have hundreds around the globe now, are ones in which there's a contingent of kids. And if there's not a contingent of kids, then there's a contingent of adults who just endlessly want to ask why, that in spite of living very harried and hurried lives, they take a couple hours out of each week or month to just tap into that childlike sensibility. Because if we lose that sense of wonder, if we really don't, and it's not just a meditative quality, but that quality of interrogation, of exploration, of what I call onefulness, of that sense that we're part of the grander scheme of things, then I think that we're missing out on one of life's most important parts. And again, I'm saying it's no accident at senior centers, for instance, that seniors who typically don't go to any activities come to a Socrates Cafe because it's all about asking why. The best groups are ones when there's like an unabashed social engineer, and I bring in elementary school kids. They're kindred spirits because they have an unflinching honesty, but they also have a way of an openness and a holistic sensibility that those of us in the middle-ish years tend to lack.
What brought you to this? You've been doing the Socrates Cafes for how many years now?
I've started Socrates Cafe in 1996 during the Clinton impeachment proceedings. Of course, now we've all come together as one.
Yeah,
kumbaya, right?
Which is true. What was it through Socrates Cafes that this occurred to you?
Well, it was in many, but you have to understand, I started out on my own inquiries with kids, and I started this in the Mission District of San Francisco with kids for whom English wasn't their primary language in 1997. And we called our groups with kids Philosophers Club, and I have a children's book by that name. I realized I was sort of engaging in the hierarchical mold. You know, I got my one of my masters in teaching, but then I realized that this kind of inquiry with kids, that they kept introducing questions and producing insights that put me almost to shame, or certainly put me in awe. And I changed my whole approach with them. I just became Chris, fellow human being Chris. Am I saying that's what we should do with them all the time? No. But it didn't in any way denigrate my specialty as a teacher or anything. It enhanced my relationships with kids when I sort of took off that teacher's hat for an hour a week and became Chris, the fellow inquirer. And magic occurred. And teachers from other classrooms would say, "What did you do to this child? She's no longer this problem causer. She's so engaged and immersed." I said, "I engaged with her as a person." And so when I went back and put on that teacher's hat, suddenly she became so engaged and involved because we saw each other differently. I started traveling around the world after Socrates Cafe came out and was published in a number of countries. Mm-hmm. And I write on my childing.org blog about my inquiries in Chiapas, Mexico with indigenous children don't go to school, my inquiries with kids in Hiroshima Peace Park. And I realized just how transformative the inquiries can be if we genuinely as adults open ourselves up to engaging with kids for a time and see that they have similar hopes and fears and aspirations, but also that they can open up new portals for us adults, a possibility to become fellow inquirers and feel a sensibility that we're all in this together.
What did you learn much or study much about the trajectory of history and how we treat children?
I did. I mean, I came about it sort of indirectly. I mean, one of the things that we study, even a cursory study of human history, shows that we tend to – adults run the show, and that we tend to carry them from one adult blunder to another, with kids caught in the crosshairs of this. I do argue that if kids had more opportunities for self-determination and if we took them into greater account, even gave them more equal consideration – then I suspect that we would design communities differently. I suspect we would govern one another differently. I certainly suspect that they would maybe have access to the kind of world-class education our former President Obama said that every kid had a right to.
A lot of times those same sort of things are said about if women had more power
right.
in the world and had not been subjugated historically and, of course, still,
right.
That things would be different.
I think so. I think in addition to womankind, if we hark back to our declaration, we also need to give account to childkind, what I call childkind. Back at our country's origins, you know, many young people risk life and limb for the same hopes for a really genuinely open society, new beginning as our adult founding fathers did. Andrew Jackson enlisted at age 13. And it's documented that kids as young as 9 enlist in a Revolutionary War, but they've never been given equal opportunity. So there are many people still left out. And I'm simply saying let's also remember, especially those of us who consider ourselves progressive, what if we also included children and those who are marginalized and actually recognize that they have different potentials than we adults, but potentials that could help us adults if we join forces with them.
We are talking about the philosophy of childing. My guest is Christopher Phillips. You know him from the Socrates Cafe books, starting with the Socrates Cafe. His new book is entitled The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. Christopher Phillips will be speaking tonight. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the philosophy of childing with best-selling author and philosopher Christopher Phillips. You probably know him from his best-selling Socrates Cafe and follow-up series of books. His new book is entitled The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. Now, Christopher Phillips, some people might say that wisdom of our youngest is sort of an oxymoron, that wisdom's something that's attained over time.
Some might. I think that wisdom is a store of experiences. I think they begin to accumulate a store of experiences before they even enter the world. But again, if you, I can inquire with a 5-year-old child in Chiapas, Mexico, where I lived for a number of years with my wife, who's from Mexico, and they have pearls of wisdom that those of us who might go through formal schooling forever in the U.S. and the Western world wouldn't have. So a child in Chiapas who's brought up basically to help support the family and sells beautiful hand-woven goods in the plaza, if you ask her, well, what a good person is, you'll be wowed. I write about this. An 8-year-old child said to me, well, a good person is someone who at least politely says no to me when I try to sell her something. And I thought, well, why is that? And she said, well, because they see me as a person. I mean, philosophers of identity and recognition like Charles Taylor, well, that's pay dirt for them. But they would never have learned it like I did from an 8-year-old who's never has any hope of going to school and who's illiterate. And she would talk about how so many tourists like me and how many locals try to brush by or even try to intentionally push her over if she tries to sell them something. She said to me, the reason you and I became friends is because you didn't buy anything from me, but you smiled when you said no. She said, and so in other words, she's saying you saw me. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot in that. And that's from a little one. You have little ones carrying littler ones on their rebozos. They can hardly stand. But there's wisdom there born from earthy experience that many of us who are privileged to be brought up in much different circumstances would never know unless we engage with them and had an inquiry with them on terms that not only that they can relate to, but that they can share fonts of wisdom that we otherwise just wouldn't know about.
You write quite a tribute to your father in this book mm-hmm. and his own childhood, mm-hmm. Which wasn't in some ways unlike that. He took on a lot of burden at a very young age.
Yes, my dad's dad, my father's, my grandfather and his family immigrated from Greece, dirt poor. And my father was relentlessly, mercilessly teased because it had a thick Greek accent, had a lisp as a result. His father died when he was 7, just keeled over from a heart attack. My father thought he was playing. So my dad suddenly had to take responsibility for the family at the ripe age of 7. He still was playful in his way. He learned how to play the piano from ear, but he had responsibilities that many of us don't have to have even until our 30s quite often. And so, like, tonight at the Barnes & Noble on Easton Town Center, I'll be talking about what is a grown-up. Well, my dad became a grown-up, I would argue, when he was 7. He had responsibilities when he was 7 and he didn't. It's not like something he did grudgingly. He didn't look back with regret. He still was able to have certain enjoyments. But nonetheless, he became what we might call an adult at a very young age. But as a result, I think when he retired, he was childlike in the sense that he took on things that he never had time to do when he was a child. And so retirement could be a great opportunity to recapture those childlike qualities like my dad did. I never feel can bemoan any setbacks or anything because I think of my dad and all that he overcame and so many who immigrate to the United States with the same hopes and dreams as my dad's family did from Athens. Congress passed a law way back then in the 20s that curtailed any further immigration from Greeks.
Right.
They didn't want them because they're dirt poor. So the things that are happening today aren't so different. But I think if we lose that quality of empathy and there but for the grace of God go I and that sense of, well, what are we all about as Americans, adults, children, if we lose that quality? I just hark back to my father and I just feel this gratefulness that that I have this opportunity because as a result, I've been able to be childlike my whole life. I never had to have had those harsh responsibilities that he had starting at age 7.
Have you thought of yourself as childlike your whole life?
I haven't. I think that I went through stages, lost stages in my 20s when I was a magazine writer. I wouldn't have thought about it then, even though I was telling other people's stories. I was a magazine writer for Parade Magazine, sharing people's stories about unsung heroes, mm-hmm. people in their own patch of the earth who are making a difference. And I loved being able to ask them questions, pepper them with questions. I had it, and yet I never really reflected enough on why. It took some years later. And then I realized, I was I love sharing their stories, but I wanted to be one of them. You know, and then I asked myself, well, how can I become one of these people imbued with social conscience as an adult who sort of lived by that philosophy of my mother and father of leaving more wood on the woodpile than when you got here at a time when self-aggrandizement and narcissism is all the rage. Not among kids. I'm tired of this. It's among adults. Mm-hmm. Let's call it for what it is. It's this pernicious case of pot calling the kettle blackism. You know, we keep saying it's about kids and kidults.
Those darn kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The adults are the ones who are really engaging. You know, they have average of 5 credit cards. They live beyond limits. Let's be honest about this. And if kids do it, then we have to ask why. Let's look at adults and how they're living and modeling things.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Christopher Phillips. He's the author of the Socrates series, Socrates Cafe. His new book is entitled The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. He, as he mentioned earlier, will be at Barnes & Noble in Easton tonight. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org. And Jim in Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ian.
Go ahead.
This is a fabulous discussion. And I'm all of a sudden I'm realizing to what I did as a scout leader in the Boy Scouts of America. Mm-hmm. And I started back in the late 80s. And we had basically what we called a boy run troop. The adults basically were on the outside periphery to keep a little order, but the troop was entirely run by the boys. You know, they started at 11 years of age. And I cannot tell you how many Eagle Awards I participated in. And, you know, I can count 60, 70 or more boys who came through our troop, you know, in those years. All are married. All have children, all have good jobs, all have the highest level of responsibility to their communities. And what Chris is talking about, you know, I just came to realize, you know, he's talking about the things that I participated in all those years ago.
What kind of qualities are you talking about when you talk about these traits? I mean, how did that work for you?
Well, when you talk about child-centered, all of the boys, when they came into the troop, the immediate emphasis was on learning, not from the adults, from each other. And it's like, as we start, because we camp like 12 months a year. We camped in December and January, and when it was 15 below zero. And my older scouts, you know, the boys at 15, 16 years of age, would go off over the hill by themselves. And I never gave it the first thought because I knew that they had brought themselves to a level of skill because they were interested, because they inquired, because they really pumped themselves up with their abilities to meet the problem. And you know, they'd show up the next morning just fine. None the worse for wear when it was 20 below zero. And I knew that they had that they would take these skills with them to do really well in their lives, and they all have.
Wow, Jim, what a wonderful adult you are. I wish I was in the Boy Scouts. I wish I'd had you as a leader.
Yeah, because so often the projects are all set there. They roll it out on a table for you.
And again, even progressive education programs rarely, if ever, really incorporate the ideas of kids to let them they talk about child-centered, but when it comes to actually letting them have a role in determining what some element of a curriculum might be.
You talked about stages of life a lot, and this is something that's been dissected by philosophers across the ages.
It has been. It's been dissected by everybody. Most of the I bring in many of the principal theorists on age and stage theory and all that. I think it says more about the age and stage theorists themselves than it does about any sort of transcendent, you know, universal aspects of stage theory. What I do argue and what it connects to this philosophy of childing that I develop in the book is that we never really let go of any previous stage. It's part of us. The earlier stages are there. We never just, you know, bridge a chasm, but there's a continuum there. And so it is that if we do get adults in our orbit, as we start growing up who speak to us in ugly or demeaning terms, or if we just simply witness them like adults engaging in an argument, you took my parking space, or when I was flying into Columbus last night, an adult just yelled at me because I was taking a picture as we were landing of just the skyline. And he said, that flash is bothering me as I'm watching a movie. Instead of, excuse me, you know, would you mind? I don't know if you noticed or not. Like a child might, would be so much more polite.
Yeah.
And I was just taken aback. It actually has never happened to me before. And I think we've become not just grumpy, but we've lost that ability to just communicate thoughtfully. Not just politely, but thoughtfully. You know, how would I want to be treated if I were on the receiving end of this? It suddenly has not even entered into adults' radar screen all too often. And I do think that we need to look back to our earliest hardwiring and how we would have been most polite. Kids don't know things about rudeness and bullying and racism until they basically learn it from adults. And it's really, really, really hard to unlearn things. So I've tried to bring up my daughters in environments. And again, I became a dad really late. I'm 57 and a half. I got a 3-year-old and a 10-year-old where those things are I'm not trying to protect them or shelter them, but I'm trying to create environments for them in which their natural inclinations towards being empathic can flourish. So like my 10-year-old child, she watched both versions of Annie. The first one is Lily White, and the second is African-American. And she said, Daddy, they're different. And I said, how? She goes, well, the second Annie's taller and skinnier. That was her distinction. And I didn't introduce anything like, oh, is there something else, Callie? Uh-huh. No, that's what she saw. And it was a beautiful revelatory thing for me. She didn't see skin color at all as any sort of distinguishing factor. And in fact, any biologist will tell you it is no distinguishing factor. This concept of race really actually doesn't exist. It's an adult invention that's pernicious and for most intents and purposes that we're 99.8% all similar, if not more. So again, if we allow that natural ability of children to grow and flourish over time without putting blinders on them, it can be expansive for us adults who have the privilege of being their steward into the world.
Children, one of the gifts of childhood that they lose as they grow up, or that we all lose, not all, but many of us do, is that empathic ability. And empathy, when I say empathic, it's a little bit different than
can be squishy.
Structuring a sense of empathy. It's empathic means they actually know how somebody's feeling better than adults do.
They do, and I think that if you look at just their communions with so-called imaginary friends, it's not just training. It's just they see things that we adults don't see. They may endow things with spirits, sort of like indigenous people do, whether it's trees. I remember when I have a 3-year-old named Sibley, and when the leaves from the tree fell from the ground for the first time, and she said, Daddy, how do we make them undead? And she brought out, and I said, I don't know. And she just brought out paint and colored them in the ways that they were when they were still on the tree during the fall season. So they do. I mean, this whole sense of onefulness and being part of things. And I make the argument, I coin another term called agefulness, that we need to embrace every age and stage of life to its fullest. And when you see adults, elder adults, who don't lament and bemoan, but still have that childlike glint, even though they've so many often tragic things have befallen them, it's really an inspiration for me about the child-adult that I want to become as I get into my 60s and then 70s and 80s, hopefully.
If you have a question or comment for Christopher Phillips, you're certainly welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the philosophy of childing. This is not a how-to book on raising a child by any means. It's a way of life. If you have a question, again, 614-292-8513. What are some other gifts of childhood that we often lose as we grow up?
Well, one of the most obvious is that there's a short window when we're young to just absorb languages like a sponge. It's a very short window.
Why is that?
I don't know. But the wiring does clearly change. I learned Spanish in my 40s after meeting and marrying my wife, Cecilia. It took me years.
Yeah.
My daughters have learned it in, we went to Mexico to visit my wife's mother, and they learned it in a matter of weeks, a course of weeks. There's no middleman. They don't have to take classes or anything.
They're not subjugated to all of the stress and –
Well, there's just an absorption and a wholefulness that they just don't have that middleman yet. But I make the argument in Philosophy of Childing, based on scientific discovery and based on studies and observations of deaf children in Nicaragua – who invented their own sign language, that it was children who created human language, not adults. And that there's a preponderance of evidence, including the great meditative poet, scientist, Dr. Lewis Thomas, who also argued the same thing. They don't just learn languages. They are the creators of language. If you bring kids together, they'll develop a pidgin language in no time. Studies show this. And why do they do it? Because they're these bundles of empathy. They want to reach out and communicate. Adults, you know, that quite often they – my grandmother, my Yaya, she learned English but grudgingly. She didn't really want to. She was all about Greek language, culture. But kids, they want to communicate. They want to reach out. They want to bridge those chasms of communication. And so you watch them in action. Just bring together 10 kids who all speak different languages. Give them a month. In no time, they'll have invented a brand new language so they can all communicate. Putting us adults to shame. But also to admiration.
Email from Hal, who writes, in my own work in criminology, where we brand adolescents as the ultimate criminal class in the making, I've come to the prediction that ageism, that children and senior adults know less than middle-aged adults, remains the ultimate bias we need to overcome. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for showing how much our children and their honesty, openness, and sensitivity have to teach us, including ourselves. And that reminds me of a reference you made to that group of third graders and senior citizens.
Yes.
I mean, their common enemy or their common antagonist, missing.
Well, it's true. There's a big segment in my book about how adolescents, if they were given half a chance to really be fully engaged and involved in the civic sphere with greater rights to self-determination, could help us older adults solve many of the most vexing and perplexing problems. They have a malleability of mind and heart at adolescent age that, again, talk about those windows that we lose as we reach into the upper echelons of adulthood. The argument is that, we still call them these raging bundles of hormones. And I was a teacher, in a six-room schoolhouse, middle school for adolescents.
Maine?
Yeah, in Maine. Yeah. But what I found when they were given the chance to engage in inquiry is that they have skills and abilities that I could learn from if I put them in the right form. I make the argument in Philosophy of Childhood, and that's the fast-paced capitalist society itself that marginalizes them. It's not any sort of foundational thing where they're these raging bundles of hormones. Margaret Mead, I argue in my book, has shown that kids, for instance, in Samoa, who are just allowed to unfold naturally as adolescents, they don't experience any of the problems that adolescents do in the United States. So then you have to ask yourself, what is the kind of structure of society that we have created around them without any input from them that has made it a self-fulfilling prophecy that this is how adolescents become? Mm-hmm. What if they had input, just as with kids, in creating the kinds of communities that they have to live within without any input whatsoever?
We're talking about the philosophy of childing. That's the title of a new book by my guest, Christopher Phillips. You may recognize him from the Socrates Cafe book and a series of follow-up books. If you have a question or comment for Christopher Phillips, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Christopher will be speaking tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Easton. For more information, check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you've ever been told to or told someone else to just grow up, You know about the notion that there's a difference between childhood and adulthood, and that it's about more than physical age. But does there have to be that much difference between my outlook on life as an adult and that of a child? We're talking about the philosophy of childing today. My guest is author and philosopher Christopher Phillips. You know him from his book Socrates Cafe and the series of Socrates books that have followed. His new book is entitled The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. If you have a question or comment for Christopher Phillips, you're certainly welcome to join the conversation. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Christopher, you refer to fluid intelligence. Mm-hmm. This is the notion that the same sort of intelligence we have as children can work for us as adults as well.
Yes. I think that if we really cultivate our sensibilities, our inborn sensibilities throughout every age and stage of curiosity, of exploration, of wonder, then we don't crystallize so much. Our brains don't crystallize so much. And again, studies today in neuroscience will bear this out. I became a dad late, first at 47, then at 54. And every day, no matter how many gazillions of mistakes I make the day before with my kids, they wake up and they're ready to give me a new chance. It's not that they forgive and forget. It's just that it's a new day. Let's see what's going to unfold today. So that's a real dose of humility for them. So now, as a dad, when I sort of take them to task, call them to the carpet for being just out of sorts, overly aggressive, I still do it, but I also have this thing where I ask myself, okay, Christopher, how about you? You know, it brings me down a few notches because when I am sleep deprived and I'm anxious, well, I can be a little aggressive and grumpy too. I can be a monster when I haven't gotten enough sleep for a few nights in a row. So it just has brought me down to a level of humility where now I don't, I sort of look at parenting more as just being a steward. You know, and this is somebody that I'm just trying to guide to the next phases in ways that just help me also cultivate those sensibilities of empathy and being more just directing and steering rather than somebody who's all about punishing and consequences and things like that. So many adults today, if you look at the raging narcissism that exists and the sense of entitlement among adults, you have to ask yourself, well, what happened? What happened along the way that there were, you know, and a lot of people say, well, there were no curbs, no limitations. And I would say, yes. But they sort of impose curbs and limitations on themselves. And adults are the ones who sort of give them that unbridled sense all too often. And now the lesson is, well, you can rise to the highest office in the land with those kinds of qualities. At the same time that we argue that, gosh, if a kid behaved that way, he'd get expelled from school, for heaven's sakes, and maybe rightfully so. So there's some real disconnect. And I do think that we all need to be looking at ourselves more with more than honesty and asking ourselves, how can we set better examples for our fellow adults and how can we sort of create environments in which kids can help us do that?
Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
It's good to talk to you. I agree very much with your author that kids see things and experience things and have empathy that as adults we're taught not to do. We're a spiritualist church, and we've had children come in 8 and 9 years old that have incredible, wonderful spiritual insights, and they're trusting. So many adults these days have just been hardened, and they expect the worst. They don't expect the best at all.
Well, that's an amazing insight. One of the things that I do assert in my book, and again, any sort of argument that I make is based on the latest social science research, but also on observations of some of our most heralded philosophers. But when they start lauding children, those observations from them tend to get short shrift, is that they do argue. This is Hume and Heidegger and Hannah Arendt, that kids have a way of asking the most bracing metaphysical questions that become much less bracing as we get older. You know, a lot of us adults will say, well, we want to give kids a firmer foundation and a belief system. But what that can really mean is a more rigid belief system when their kids are just natural-born openists. And so they will. They'll incorporate a little bit of this, a little bit of that from various belief systems if given half the chance. And it can be really instructive for us as we go through our latter years. And if we don't want to sort of close ourselves off to new possibilities, maybe new surprises about what it can mean to exist in this world.
You know, Jim, I'm curious. You're a minister, I gather from the description with the call. And you know, when I was growing up, our church always separated the kids from the adults.
Well, Spiritualist churches tend to have a much older congregation, but we do have children. I think the biggest teacher of morality for kids is they watch us. And if there's any inconsistencies, they'll detect it immediately. So if you want your kid to grow up being honest and being empathetic and not holding racial prejudices, you have to do that every day, because as soon as you're inconsistent, they'll spot it, and often they'll call you out.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
How much of our ability to embrace the philosophy of childing is wrapped up in our own identity? You spend a lot of time talking about how we self-identify, how we wonder how other people see us. We're always trying to figure that out. Is that part of adulting or childing?
Yeah, adulting is another really cool word that doesn't exist that I think you and I need to do all we can to bring it into the lexicon. It actually never existed, but I think, again, if
as opposed to childing.
Yes, but I'm into process.
Yeah.
And I think that there are these, you know, we can, it's an arbitrary thing, but, you know, there's children, there's adults. But if we look at life as a process of constantly becoming and being at the same time, then I think we sort of look at ourselves as sculptures in the making, works in progress, until our very last breath, and as we're still just asking questions and wondering. As long as we continue to do that, we'll always, even when my daughter's already talking about the time when they'll probably have to push me in a wheelchair, but as long as I retain those qualities of curiosity and wonder and have others with whom to ask those questions, then I hope that I can safely say that life won't be so bad, because that means that there's always maybe some new portal just waiting there for me to discover, even when I physically can't move so much anymore. And again, I think that's when it becomes really essential to somehow have kids in our orbit. There's these wonderful people at nursing homes I go to who go to a lot of effort and through a lot of bureaucratic rigmarole to bring kids in when I have my inquiries. And it opens up both of their worlds. They enter as strangers and they leave like long-lost relatives.
What's that like? You write about that quite a bit in the book. It's you've seen and observed.
Among our oldest and our youngest, there's a relentless honesty and a relentless probing that's based on that why. That for a variety of reasons, many of them quite understandable, that adults in between them, those ages, tend to lose out. You know, we're involved in trying to work several jobs to make ends meet, for heaven's sakes. It's really hard to take time. But quite often in our older years, suddenly we have that time again. And if we reconnect, if we leap over that barrier and get some kids in that same orbit, we'll It's very meaningful and helpful to both age groups. And it's very instructive to somebody like me who's in the middle to realize that, gosh, I'd always thought that as we got older, we became more crystallized in our ability to, to think and do and be. But I actually think now that just this is observational. I would hope that some cognitive science and neuroscientists would someday confirm it, that actually that crystallization can become less so as we enter our very older years and we become more and more childlike. We become in some ways more helpless and dependent on others, but in a way that can give us a humility and a time and sensibility to want to reach out and realize that, you know, we do need others. We do, and not just others' physical help, but philosophical help, for lack of a better way of putting it, to engage with. Because quite often it's in those latter years that suddenly we become childlike again and want to ask why, and don't have anybody to ask them with us.
No one to hang out with. You know, children need adults and vice versa. And so then what happens to adults who are separated from children? Children always have adults around, mm-hmm. all things being equal. But adults, lots of times, they've decided at some point in their life they didn't have children.
Right.
They don't like children. That's that. And
right.
They think that's sort of a badge of honor. Uh-huh. They've defined themselves and they yeah. feel real good about that. We all know someone who doesn't like children. What's going on yeah. there?
That's a great question. I have a lot of adult friends who just didn't want to have kids.
Yeah. That's different than saying, well, I don't like kids.
Or really, when I bring my kids to visit them and suddenly it's not all about them.
Yeah.
They don't like that. So you make the call. What does that mean? Does it mean, you know, suddenly the tension doesn't swirl around them so much? That suddenly a decision was made that, you know, I want to live in this cloister. I have the ability and means to, so I don't need kids. Now, my argument is that they're missing out on something big time. On the other hand, if that's the way that they choose to live, then that's the way it is. But I do think they're missing out on something. At least I wish that they would still read books like Anne of Green Gables.
Mm-hmm.
And again, talk about precocious. This is how kids talk, though. Quite often we write in children's
True.
Books in ways that are actually diluted, that we make them sound kid-like in ways that please us adults. I mean, those are books that are of timeless and transcendent quality. I still read these books whether I have a child
Little
with
women,
me or not.
Yeah,
yes, absolutely.
That's right. That's an interesting point. You asked the question, what kind of looking glass are you for others?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you ask that?
Because I think that we need to be cognizant and conscious of the person that we're trying to be and become. It's no accident that the philosopher Socrates still speaks to us over the eons. He lived a certain way, and he didn't start living that certain way until quite late in life.
Mm-hmm.
In his, so, you know, 60s, 70s. Why is it that certain paradigmatic figures like Nelson Mandela, I mean, how can I ever feel sorry for myself when this man was jailed for decades, didn't come into his own until became a senior citizen, but live with that childlike glint and sparkle that can serve as an example to all of us who bemoan, oh, if I'd only done this and hadn't done that. We still got time. And if you look at the way that kids wake up without that sense of regret, but that this is a new day, a new opportunity to seize the day, that really reflects that sparkle that was in Nelson Mandela's eyes or Socrates' eyes. And I think there's few excuses not to try to live just here and now to the fullest.
And then we're almost out of time, but I just want to ask you, how much can we or should we tell children about this symbiotic relationship that's mm-hmm. available to us?
I think that the best way to tell is to show.
Just do it.
And so, for instance, many of my Socrates Cafe groups are intentionally held in the children's library section but are open to all people of all ages. The one that I do pretty regularly in Tacoma Park, Maryland, is one, you know, so we adults have to sit in the uncomfortable chairs of kids rather than the other way around.
Interesting, yeah.
And so, you know, adults come in, multiple PhDs, highly accomplished people in that area. They have to bring down those $50 words to 25-cent words. And they realize not only is it not diluting their thought, but suddenly they feel really good when they can convey their thinking to kids, and not just as an end in itself, because then a kid has the opportunity to maybe ask them questions that might enrich and enhance their professional inquiries. That actually happens. I make the wacky argument that we should populate our research offices with kids, not just as some career development thing.
Yeah.
But then say, well, what question would you have that might help me? They might not ask, why is the sky blue? They might ask, why is there a sky? You know, and suddenly it might be pay dirt. I mean, kids, and I argue this in my book, I mean, cosmologists and physicists just getting with the program that there's these things called multiverses. I was an elementary school teacher, just read a kid's paper. They've been with the program on multiverses forever. And so it's not just a flippant argument. They're more open to the fact that time both advances and regresses. These are things physicists are just understanding.
Uh-huh.
A kid's sensibility is already in tune to that. And so we can actually maybe say, wow, let's see if what this kid says is actually true. And it might actually enhance our own professional inquiries in a variety of fields, I would argue, even the most seemingly not imaginative field.
Christopher Phillips, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anne.
Christopher Phillips, the author of The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. He will be speaking tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Easton. For more information, you can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.